This week we discuss another big gas project for WA, some positive economic data, the debate over homelessness, Metronet, the agency, and the future of interest rates.
Welcome to Mark My Words, the weekly podcast from Business News, with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer discussing the important business news and data stories from Western Australia.
Welcome to this episode of Mark My Words, which is brought to you by our new sponsor, Murdoch University. I'm Mark Beyer, and joined today by Matt McKenzie.
Excited to be here, Mark. Now, you had some excitement this week at the unveiling of a new project up north. It's gas, it's chemicals. Tell me about it.
Look, it's always interesting when you go along to an event where there's a group of people that you've not previously heard of, with some financial backers that you don't know of, telling us they have plans for a $4 billion gas project at the town of Derby up in the Kimberley. So that's what I experienced this week. It was so it's called Derby Fertilizer and Petrochemical Complex. The managing director of this company is a gentleman named Alfred Benedict. He's a person who's worked internationally in the oil and gas industry for more than 30 years. He has considerable experience, including a time when one of his companies was contracted to run and maintain the Burrup Fertilisers project up in the Pilbara. Mm. Now, Alfred has spotted an opportunity to develop and produce ammonia and methanol and export it to Japan.
Right.
He's set up a local company just last year with paid up capital of $10 million. But he's also signed up a group in Dubai named ARJ Group, which, to be honest, someone I've not been familiar with. Mm. They appear to be a very large and diversified group, which is planning to become the major equity holder in this very ambitious gas project. They're in the process of having discussions with international banks, which the aim is that they'll put in 80% of the cost. So we're talking very serious money here. They've got a MOU with a local company called Thea Energy. They've been doing some drilling onshore in the Canning Basin. Mm. They've only done one well, but they're very positive that there's lots of oil and gas up there.
Well, there's a lot of gas up there, but getting it out is the question, I think, isn't it?
That's right. It's a minimal infrastructure up there. A few other people have gone in and had some very expensive drilling campaigns. We're talking at least $10 million per well in that part of the world. Also, they have an MOU with a Chinese company called Shanghai Electric. So the intention is to transition from gas to being a purely renewable project, planning for a 100 megawatt solar power plant at Derby. So this is very big stuff. Aiming to start construction at the end of this year.
Yeah, right.
Now, that once again, I keep on using this word ambitious. Yeah. That timeline for a group that's new on the scene, there's always a lot of work to be done before these things kick off. And I guess we've got some context around that because there's a few other groups that have been working for a long while on similar projects, one of which is Perdaman Industries, led by Vikas Rumbal, who, of course, was one of the founders of Burrup Fertilisers.
Can you just give us a bit of background on Burrup Fertilisers?
So the main person there is Pankaj Oswal, perhaps best known as the person that wanted to build the Taj on the Swan. Mm. He had that super block in Peppermint Grove and started construction of a very extravagant house there. Before he ran into financial difficulties, had a run-in with his bank, the ANZ, he ended up selling out and moving back overseas. But very early on, Vikas Rumbal had been his partner, but they had a falling out. He got bought out of the business, and Vikas has subsequently been running various other businesses and investments and so on. But he's got plans for a $4.5 billion urea project on the Burrup Peninsula. Mm. He's got agreements with Woodside. He's signed up Clough and SAPEM as his engineering contractors, aiming for a final investment decision in the middle of this year. Mm. So add to that, just last week in this podcast, we talked about Strike Energy. They announced plans for a urea project at Geraldton, $2.3 billion. Mm. So the common theme here, lots of gas in Western Australia, and lots of people seeing opportunities to process that gas into these fertiliser projects and petrochemical projects, either to supply local farmers or to export to places like Japan, where there'll be further processing.
Let me just throw something in there by contrast while we're on this topic. What's the other use of gas? You can just liquefy it and send it overseas. And Woodside just reported, I think it was yesterday, that they're getting the highest spot price for their gas shipments that they've ever had, higher even than 2012. That's in the quarter ahead. They also said the premium that they're getting for Wheatstone condensate and Vincent crude is at an all-time high. Now, the LNG market has turned very, very rapidly in the past few months, much to everyone's surprise. And I think there's some encouraging signs there for a potential Scarborough development to actually get the go-ahead. It's been delayed because of COVID and all the rest of it, including the Woodside has also this week announced that it has extended or expanded an agreement with Uniper for offtake. So gas, whether being shipped overseas or being manufactured into something else, maybe a boom looming in WA.
If that were to happen, there's a real issue here about labour supply. We're going to talk about the labour force numbers in a moment, but we've got infrastructure booming, we've got iron ore projects, numerous iron ore projects continuing. If all these gas projects get off the ground, one part of me says fantastic for Western Australia, the other part of me raises concern about, you know, are there enough people in Western Australia to do the work on these projects?
What probability do you give all three getting up, or let's be realistic, a couple of them getting up?
Well, look, I think the Woodside Scarborough project, things seem to be lining up for that, and certainly there's a determination on the part of the company to make that happen. As far as these other fertiliser projects go, look, I think it's a high likelihood we'll have at least one of them, maybe two. Very unlikely that all three will get up. Nonetheless, each of them on their own is a very significant boost to the WA economy. So Matt, rounding back on labour force, we had some new numbers during the week and some positive economic news.
Yeah, employment steady in WA in the most recent data, December. I'm jumping ahead of myself there. I'm in a time machine. December, yeah, the employment numbers were steady. Unemployment fell ever so slightly, 0.2 percentage points to be 6.2%. And for those of you wondering, I presume that means that people left the labour force. It was only a small number, a couple of thousand, I think, left the labour force. Nationally, unemployment down to 6.6%. And just to give you an idea of how we've, as Western Australians, performed through COVID, The number of people employed in WA in the month of December, seasonally adjusted, is just 2,000 less than in February last year prior to COVID. So very strong numbers. Building approvals in October 2020 up 103% compared to October 2019. Compared to the previous quarter, up 98%. And WA's improvement was the biggest in the nation. And that all follows a big amount of stimulus that's happening in the housing industry. There's, the government's got all sorts of grants to try and encourage people to buy homes and all the rest of it, which leaves us in an interesting question, is that people are going to be buying, building homes, people are going to be potentially building gas projects, and the labour unemployment numbers are coming down. So what do you think that all points to, Mark?
Particularly on the building industry, I think the government has recognised that the take-up of that stimulus has been probably stronger than they expected. So they've already announced an extension of time during which people can go ahead with their house construction projects to try and smooth out the work. But there again, the risk there is that we'll have this surge in activity. It'll be very concentrated, and then after that's over, it'll fall away again. So that's going to be a tough one to manage. Back on the jobs numbers, Matt, I saw an announcement from Premier Mark McGowan hailing the numbers and saying that Western Australia was outperforming the rest of the country. But I also heard the Federal Jobs Minister, Michaelia Cash, on the radio talking about what a great set of numbers they were sort of right across Australia. So what's your take on how Western Australia is performing relative to the rest of the country?
Well, I tell you what, if you had told us in March or April last year, as the world seemed to be falling apart, that we'd be reporting unemployment numbers less than 7%, I think we'd all be very impressed with that, whether you be nationally or at a state level. Look, you know, WA has recovered, in my view, more strongly than any other states, but that's not to say that other states are doing poorly. I mean, that 6.6% unemployment nationally is a pretty good indicator that the country as a whole is going very well. In WA, I did notice the latest numbers from the ABS on payroll data, which is sort of it's an index they've been running purely through the COVID period. It's not a regular index they run; it's fortnightly. Shows that wages actually, in terms of since the pandemic broke out, wages in WA have fared worse than other states. But that was partly because of the Christmas period and all the rest of it. So we'll have to see in weeks ahead whether that sort of fixes itself up. But wage growth, or wages falling more here than in other places, even though the jobs numbers are a little bit better.
Mm. Okay, thanks. Let's move on to another topic. The hot topic of debate in WA politics this week is around homelessness, triggered by the establishment of a camp opposite Fremantle train station in one of the parks there. So Matt, tell us about this camp and tell us a bit about the debate that's been going on.
Well, let me start with a positive, and I can tell you I'm informed by one of the service providers that in the past week, six individuals and one family from the camp have found accommodation through that service provider. So that is some good news, is that things are happening there. I went down there and I spoke to some people, and it was very interesting. A couple of guys, Max and Richard, who just basically, Max was in prison until 6 months ago. He got out of prison, and then they sort of said, "Oh well, you know, good luck to you," more or less. And he told me that he's been homeless or couch surfing or street prison, mostly couch surfing, ever since. Difficult circumstances. Richard, similarly, he said, look, a lot of these guys, they get out of prison and, you know, they've got nowhere to stay. It's hard to integrate back into the community. So that's something we need to think about, perhaps, as a state, is how we help these guys that have been in incarceration to get back out and get back into the community. But the debate this week, Zach Kirkup announced emergency beds in the area. And he says, well, there's a tent city here. We need some beds to help these people. Mark McGowan says there already are beds. My information from talking to the service providers is that there are some beds available. But when you go down there and you speak to these guys, you know, they said basically they couldn't find beds. Mark McGowan said there's professional protesters that are organising this. And, you know, the person who is one of the spokespeople, one of the organisers of this event, was involved in Extinction Rebellion and other things like that. That, of course, doesn't mean that the other people that are actually staying there aren't genuinely homeless. So I did speak to one woman who was there just to support the cause, who had a house. But as I said, I spoke to a couple of others, and one of my colleagues spoke to some other people that had, you know, been in some pretty severely difficult circumstances. So what's basically happened is someone's organised a Boxing Day lunch event in Fremantle. And they've said, you know, no one else is going to be providing food, which was incorrect because there were places providing food. And then some people set up some tents, and they said that they'd be providing some shelter, and some people set up some tents, and I looked at a video from around Boxing Day, and there was a few tents there, and now the whole place is stacked full of 80 tents or something like that. And now the view of Mark McGowan is basically this has been organised by activists to try to cause an issue going into the election. The view of the organisers is, well, these people are all homeless and, you know, we don't really care if we make a bit of a scene going into the election because we want you to help these people, more or less. The thing that shocked me is that people have said the Department of Communities has a fewer or lower number of houses than they did 4 years ago. And I thought to myself, surely that must be wrong. Someone's misread the data. It just wouldn't make sense to me that we would have less social housing than than we did 4 years ago. But I just got the numbers this morning from the Department of Communities, and it is slightly less than 4 years ago, which is surprising. So the government's invested a lot of money in improving the quality of accommodation, but not necessarily in getting more accommodation online. So many complex issues there.
And Matt, does that encompass the emergency housing or social housing provided by not-for-profit groups as well?
No, I think it's just the department's numbers.
Okay. Yeah, look, it's been, I found it quite fascinating because certainly the tent city at Fremantle is not a realistic or effective long-term solution, but it certainly has thrown the spotlight on the issue. And it's one of those issues that just it knocks around year after year. No easy solution, that's quite clear. The Premier has expressed a lot of frustration. He's even suggested that people have been lured away from existing accommodation down to this tent city. Certainly hope that's not been the case.
I think it's possible.
It's possible. And look, one of the challenges, of course, is that people who are homeless, there's a whole range of factors that will contribute to them being in that circumstance. So, you know, financial and mental health and employment and, as you say, time in the prison system as well. And they all sort of come together and a really tough one to deal with.
You're absolutely right there. It's very complicated. And I think, you know, people have very strong views on this issue. Some people will say, oh, you know, we don't want these people out the front of our business, which is entirely fair. Others will say, well, why don't we do more as a society to help people? And one thing I think we should just always reflect back on is that prior to the pandemic, before there was any COVID, the Australian government reported in its budget $180 billion a year on social security and welfare. $180 billion, yet we still have these problems, which suggests to me that something is going wrong somewhere and exactly how we are using that money to try to fix the problems, Mark.
People falling through the cracks.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Now, we'll take a short break now and hear from our sponsor.
Business education needs to evolve. Right now, we're in a new era of business, so we need a new breed of business graduate. At Murdoch, we're rethinking how we do business with future-focused courses co-created by industry and a chance to fast-track your career through accelerated learning. It's our business to rethink business education. Enrol now for the new Bachelor of Commerce at murdoch.edu.au. Murdoch University. Free your think.
Matt, we had a few updates during the week from the state government on their Metronet program. Big opportunities there for contractors. Can you give us an update?
Yeah, three projects where they've basically selected preferred bidders that are going to move through to the next stage. The big one is Byford, the rail extension to the Armidale line, $481 million that's valued at, and they're going to be making a decision by mid-2021. Two consortiums, one led by Downer, which was over everything this week, and Lang O'Rourke. Second project, level crossing removals on the Armidale line. There's three level crossings to be removed, but they'll be getting costings apparently for six if they want to expand it. $208 million, that's the budgeted number. Downer again, and Acciona and Coleman Rail leading the other consortium. And finally, the redevelopment and moving, I think, of Midland Station. Again, that's Downer, and then a local sort of Giorgio group and McConnell Dow working on that one. So these things they'll be making decisions in the year ahead, and some of these things are going to start to get underway. And Mark, I know you're going to give some views in a moment on how everything's progressing. But it's also worth noting that the government came out and said that they had so far let, is that the word I'm looking for? $35 million of contracts for the rail car manufacturing to local businesses. And one business this week that was mentioned as a local business that had won work and started employing people was InfraBuild, which is out in the East Metro region. So there you go.
Yeah, I think the 35 mil was the, if you like, the latest update. I suspect there's more than that. Certainly that project to build new rail cars out at Midland, overall that's a very significant development. They're building a new assembly hall out there. I think the aim is that at least half the work on the new rail cars will have to happen in Western Australia.
Yes.
So that's certainly the aim, is to have a longer term sustainable business around that, over and above the construction work on the new rail lines, etc. Look, I think on the contracting front, there's certainly a lot of opportunity there. The frustration I've had with the Metronet program is that it's taken a long while for work to actually get underway. I mean, it was 4 years ago when the McGowan government, or before Mark McGowan was elected Premier, you know, this was the big pitch that they had, and Metronet was going to transform public transport in Perth, or rail transport. And look, longer term, it will do that. But while there's preliminary and early stage works happening on quite a few of the projects, most of them, the work hasn't really got underway yet. Mm. And so it's taken a bit longer than anticipated. But the way things are shaping up over the next couple of years, there will be a lot more work happening there. And that's on top of all the work on freeway extensions and new roads and bridges and so on. So government infrastructure, particularly in that transport field, is a very significant part of stimulus for WA and a good opportunity.
Mark, on another front entirely, you've just had a look at the agency, which had a bit of a rough week.
Yeah, look, this is an interesting case here. The agency is an ASX-listed company in the real estate business. They've got a different business model from traditional real estate firms. They're trying to shake up the industry. I know they've signed up a lot of people around the country, and they've become a very significant force in the industry. But they've always... managing their finances has been a challenge at times. They've raised new capital on a number of occasions. The news during the week was the appointment of an administrator to the parent company. Now, the company has responded by saying, describing this as the purported appointment or the alleged appointment of an administrator. So this case has, I think, implications for anyone running a company where you run into a dispute with a creditor. Now, in this case, there was a company called Magnolia Group, led by Mitchell Atkins. He, in fact, used to be a director of the agency group, and he's also a 16% shareholder. And he said, look, the company owes me money. They haven't been paying it back, so I've arranged for BDO to be appointed voluntary administrator. This is something I've not really come across very much, because the normal course of events, it's the directors themselves, if they have concerns about the solvency of their business, they then appoint a voluntary administrator. If there's a creditor that has issues, the normal path they'll take is to appoint a receiver to look after their interests. So this was an unusual one. Now, the reality is, if you're a creditor who has an interest in a substantial portion of the company's assets, you do have the rights to appoint an administrator. But it's a path that you don't often see. The two parties ended up in the Supreme Court the day after. Now, the reality is that all the operating businesses are not in administration, so it's business as usual for the agency. That's a point they were keen to emphasise. And in fact, they talked about the debt. They're disputing whether, in fact, there is a debt. They described it as alleged fees on a mandate to secure some debt funding, which, in fact, was not delivered. Mm. So they're saying, well, in reality, the debt may not be there at all. Nonetheless, this was the premise that Magnolia Group used to appoint administrators. So look, it's, I guess, another example of risks facing companies, particularly when they get into a dispute with their creditors. Effectively, things have been put on hold by the Supreme Court. Everyone will be back in court in, I think, the 1st of February, when things should be resolved more substantively. But in the meantime, we'll watch it with keen interest to see how this one pans out. Now, Matt, let's move on to our final topic for the podcast, the future of interest rates at a global level. There's been some significant shifts there.
Yeah, Tim Treadgold, in his column in this week's magazine, says he reckons this is the first hints of a reversal in the rate cycle. So US Treasury yields for 10 years up 24.8%, and I want to stress that's percent, not percentage points. 30-year yields up 11%. Similarly in Australia, Tim said over 10 weeks, so that was in the space of 1 week for the US. In Australia, over 10 weeks, a 46% increase in yield. And I checked Bloomberg this morning. You know, if you have a 10-year Treasury bond, the yield is 1.11% at the moment. So all of that should suggest to you that investors are expecting interest rates to potentially start to rise, maybe not immediately, but in the near term. The other thing that makes it...
And just for context there, that would be the first time that's happened in a long, long while.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. The trend since the global financial crisis has been that interest rates and yields have been... The mega trend almost has been that they've been lowering and lowering and lowering. It's interesting in Australia, the RBA has a yield target, which is obviously quite a significant intervention in the market that they undertook during the pandemic. Not many other countries specifically used a yield target. And that will be suppressing sort of short-term interest rates for now while they're undertaking those actions. But there was a FOI request that was revealed this week, and in this, the RBA has estimated that a permanent 1% fall in the cash rate, so if you believe it's permanent, would lead to a 30% increase in house prices, which led to some media reporting about potential increases in house prices and asset prices and all the rest of it. All of this, to me, indicates that there's starting to be some consideration out there that there's inflation pressure. Now, I could be wrong, I'm not the expert, but we'll see what happens in the CPI next week and in the years ahead. But golly, we've had a lot of easing in monetary policy, particularly during the pandemic. And as we saw with those unemployment numbers, things are nowhere near as bad as we expected they might be, probably because governments intervened and took action. The RBA has promised this yield target for 3 years, so they're locked into this loose monetary policy. And I expect that people are going to start to see inflation.
Though on that point, Matt, the Reserve Bank's long-term target for inflation for Australia is 2-3%
yes.
per year over time. We've been below that level for, I think, at least 2-3 years. And so the Reserve Bank, their view is that actually they want a bit of inflation.
Yes.
And that could be underpinned by higher wages growth, which will support consumer spending, etc. So I guess historically we've always thought of inflation as a bad thing when it gets out of control.
Mm.
The Reserve Bank is saying we actually want a bit of inflation. Is that fair to say that would be a good thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the bank's position. They want to get things back to the target. But of course that impacts yields and all the rest of it too, because when you start having higher level of inflation, that'll impact, you know, your bond yields and the interest rates people pay on longer term debt and such.
Yeah. And potentially big implications for superannuation funds, because they've got a lot of their money wrapped up in government bonds. And of course there's an inverse relationship between the yield and the price of government bonds. So as the yield goes up, the price will fall, and that could be reflected in the returns that superannuation funds report. So, okay, lots of developments there for people to keep an eye on. Thank you very much, Matt. I'll let listeners know that Business News will be hosting a breakfast with the WA Liberal Party leader, Zach Kirkup, on Wednesday, the 3rd of February at Crown Perth. So it's your chance to hear firsthand on Zach Kirkup's plans ahead of the state election in March. If you're interested, give us a call or go to our website, www.businessnews.com.au, and click on the events tab to make your booking. Thanks for listening. This episode of Mark My Words was brought to you by Murdoch University.
Thanks for listening to Mark My Words with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer from Business News. For more information, please go to businessnews.com.au/podcasts. And to receive these regularly, search for Business News WA in iTunes or SoundCloud.